This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Bush and other coalition leaders take pains to separate politics and religion. This war, they say, is a fight against terrorism and not against Islam. Osama bin Laden and his supporters, though, portray it very differently. They use terms like jihad, emphasize President Bush's single reference to a crusade, and call on all Muslims to stand up against crusaders, Jews, and hypocrites. Islamic scholars tell us there's an enormous gap between the rhetoric of Islamic extremists and the beliefs of the Muslim majority. But they also explain that Islam plays a role in all aspects of the lives of its adherents, in politics, economics, in science, that Muslims integrate the spiritual and temporal realms. So while this may not be a war against Islam, is it in some ways about Islam? If we overlook the religious element, do we ignore a key component in understanding the conflict, not to mention the combatants? What is the role of Islam? President Bush, is he right when he says that Osama bin Laden and his supporters blaspheme Islam, or is there something fundamental about Islam that allows Osama's rhetoric to resonate? We'll be asking these questions today and tomorrow in a two-part look at Islam and that religion's role in Muslim society. Today we talk with scholars who think religion does have a role and explain how Islam influences today's politics, economics, and science, especially in the Islamic world. Tomorrow we'll speak with American Muslim leaders about the role of Islam in America and how they see their place in American society and the place of American Muslims in the Islamic world. What does religion, what does Islam have to do with all of this? To join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Mark Juergensmeyer, and he's a professor of sociology and director of global and international studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's also the author of Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence. He's speaking with us from his home in Santa Barbara, and welcome.
My pleasure.
You've obviously studied the role of religion in politics and society. So what do you say to the declaration by President Bush, for example, and most of the rest of the world, that this war is not about Islam?
Well, in a sense, he's right. It's not about the kind of Islam that most Muslims believe in and that most beloved Muslims adhere to. Muslims throughout the world were as horrified as we were to see the awful attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. But in another sense, it is about Islam, in the sense that those people who perpetrated the acts are seeped with a sense of religious mission and duty. They've implanted the images of cosmic war out of their own traditions, as almost every other religious terrorist does, be they Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Sikh, Hindu, whatever. The images of cosmic war reside in every religious tradition, ready to be implanted onto a social plane and to bring life to social and political causes.
Well, as you say, there is an aspect of that in Christianity, the religion that most of us are most familiar with. But to some degree, all of these religions have, you know, if you go back to either the Quran or the Bible, there are passages that would seem to justify a lot of different things. You know, embrace, you know, holy war on one hand and love all of your brothers on the other hand.
Every religious tradition has this notion of struggle. For most people who are religious, this is an internal struggle. We think of this as a kind of metaphor of the war within the soul, the internal fight. When we Protestants sing Onward Christian Soldiers, They're talking about a kind of spiritual battle in which they're engaged. It's only a few religious people who then implant that religious vision onto a social and political a plane, and thereby are exhilarated with the sense of power they get in religionizing power, politics, a feeling that God is involved in these earthly struggles.
Now, a lot of Christians seem to have gotten beyond this a couple of hundred years ago. Is that the case with Islam, or is a larger percentage of the Muslim community still in belief with that idea?
Yeah, but before we dismiss the images of Christianity to being old-fashioned, remember the last attack, the most serious attack of terrorist attack before the World Trade Center bombings on September 11th was a Christian terrorist, Timothy McVeigh, who had an image of cosmic war that came out of Christendom that he had implanted in on the world, in which he saw his attacks on Oklahoma City as being a part.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's as marginal to Islam, really, as it is to Christianity. Unless Osama bin Laden can be successful in persuading the rest of the Muslim world that this attack was so extraordinary, that this war was so palpable, that they should join it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, America's military act in response has, in some quarters, fueled exactly that image. In some ironic and paradoxical way, it's given support to this terrorist vision.
Well, let me follow up just a moment on Timothy McVeigh. And, you know, he wasn't claiming to be a Christian, nor was he claiming that his act was a message, you know, an inspiration for the way that all Christians should behave.
In a sense, it was, though. The cosmotheism of the Turner Diaries that William Pierce talks about imagines a great war between...
That's the book that McVeigh drew much of his ideology
exactly.
From.
It was implicitly a religious document. It's true that Osama bin Laden speaks in a much more direct way to his own religious community and imagines in a more direct way a kind of a war between the forces of Islam and Christianity, but of Islam in the secular world, but in the same sense, it's a kind of imagined war that can come into being only with the credibility that military action gives it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it is dangerous to ignore the religious aspect of this conflict?
Sure, in that religion is seamlessly a part of this vision. Even those activists who struggle for physical territory, let's say, in Palestine with the Hamas movement. Once religion comes and absolutizes the struggle, this raises the struggle to a new dimension. It gives the timeline of the struggle a much longer view. After all, if the battle is lost within one's own lifetime, you don't need to worry because eventually God will succeed. This means that you can be involved in what appear to be losing battles as Hamas is, with the confidence that ultimately you'll succeed because God is on your side.
How do we then address the religious part or the religious aspect of this?
Well, I think in two ways. One is to certainly support the more moderate views of religion, those people within the tradition who see the struggle as being metaphorical, as being not simply in black and white political and social terms. To try to help work with those people who are trying to solve the problems of the Muslim world in which America is identified as an enemy in Israel and Palestine and in Iraq and Kashmir, to help diminish the potential for the support of this view that casts America as the absolute enemy. That's one way. But another way is to allow a room for religion in public life. I disagree in some ways very strongly with the suggestion of Salman Rushdie that we need to get religion out of public life. I think one of the cures for the problem of religion in public life is to provide a space that brings that sense of morality and spirituality, that dimension of public community, into juxtaposition with the secular values of tolerance and fair play that we also believe should be a part of any civil order.
Well, one of the things that you were talking about, an article I think that Salman Rushdie wrote in an op-ed page article in the New York Times, but one of the things that he was talking about there was separation of church and state as a goal towards that we should aspire to.
Yeah, there's no question that I think a civil society needs to be not under the domination of one particular creed or one intolerant group. At the same time, there is a sense of morality and of spiritual wholeness that religion can bring to public life that's affirming and valuable, especially when Enlightenment values are seen to be only protecting the greedy and the corrupt. That's not true, of course, but insofar as that perception exists, the bringing of lifting into public life the the sense of morality and of honesty and integrity that religion sometimes gives might be a positive thing indeed.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our first caller is Ken, who's on the line with us from Cleveland.
Yeah, hi. I would define the conflict a little bit, a small bit differently. It's not really religion against society, but fundamentalism against modern or better said, contemporary culture. We had fundamentalist Christians bombing abortion clinics and killing doctors and causing other kinds of trouble. This is, you know, seems to me to be, you know, in terms of the conflict, essentially the same thing. It is not that, you know, we're having a war against Islam, but it's fundamentalism. We weren't having a war against Christians, or they weren't waging. It wasn't Christians waging war on us. It was fundamentalism, which I see as, yeah, it has a religious element, but it's far more cultural than I would say religious. And I think the VOA and the CIA should take a look at the cultural thing. And we're really not going to get out from under this whole situation until, number one, we frame the question, the issue, the conflict correctly, and two, go at the fundamentalist arguments that they have against contemporary culture. Because, I mean, the ideology is going to keep on spreading, you know, that fundamentalist ideology is going to keep going unless we address that and, you know, show its soft underbelly, defeat the arguments that they propose. I mean, they use religion to justify what they're doing. You know, with God on your side, everything's okay. But, you know, we've got to address that issue. Otherwise, you know, fundamentalists are going to, you know, keep on attacking modern culture.
Well, let Professor Juergensmeyer have a chance to respond.
I agree with the caller. In many ways, the fight is within the Islamic world and within the Christian world over the way in which religion is going to respond to modernity. When I interviewed Mahmoud Abu Lima, who was one of the men convicted of the 1993 attack of the World Trade Center, he displayed a great deal of frustration about the way in which not just ordinary Americans, but also moderate Muslims, right, in his point of view, missed the boat. They just didn't see the great issues that were going on. It was extraordinarily frustrating to him that so many of his fellow Muslims could simply exist as if there were not a great battle with the secular West, there were not these hideous visions of cosmic war that he imagined in his mind. So there's no question in my mind that the attack on the World Trade Center was meant not only to show Americans that there was a great war going on that we needed to be aware of and engaged in, but it was an attack meant not just for CNN, but also for Al Jazeera television, for the CNN of the Arab world. It was meant for a Muslim audience, so that Muslims would see that America was targeted and that they needed to rise up and to be engaged in this struggle that was going on. The frustration is with their fellow Muslims as much as it is with the secularists.
Ken, thanks for the call.
Sure.
Okay. We'll be back to discuss this question and many more when we return after a short break. This is part one of a two-day discussion about Islam and its role. Right now, we're talking about the intersection of Islam and politics. When we return, we'll hear about how some Islamic beliefs may have influenced the development of economies, and we'll continue taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, or you can send us an email. That address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing Islam today and tomorrow. Many Muslims say the religion plays a role in all aspects of their lives, and we're speaking at the moment about how it's shaped politics in the Muslim world. On the line with us from Santa Barbara, California, is Mark Juergensmeyer, a professor of sociology, director of global and international studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. We want to shift the conversation to economics in just a minute. But, Professor, I wanted to follow up. We were talking just before the break about modernism and fundamentalism. And the same tension, as you point out, exists in the Christian world as well. Why does it seem, though, to have so much more resonance in the Islamic world? Or is that a misperception on our part? And by that, I mean that Timothy McVeigh's act in Oklahoma City seemed to, if anything, reduce support for fundamentalist Christian, violent fundamentalist Christian organizations. Is this act, the events of September the 11th, is that having a similar effect in the Islamic world, do you think?
Well, I think America's response to the attack on September 11th is also part of the event, in that the response in the Muslim world, the outpouring of people, is not in defense of the attack on the World Trade Center towers. In fact, the immediate response was of horror and of disdain, certainly among modern Muslims and probably among most Muslims who have otherwise disposed against the United States. But then the attack and the way it was portrayed and the way it continues to be portrayed, we probably don't see these images on American television the same way that they do within the Muslim world. But it in many ways appears to confirm, at least among a certain segment of the Muslim population, that image that Osama bin Laden wants to portray of America being the satanic evil power that uses military in an indiscriminate way.
All right, we're going to move on to economics now. Please stay with us. And we want to invite, of course, you listeners to join the conversation. Our telephone number is 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us now is Timur Kuran. He's a professor of economics and law, as well as a professor of Islamic thought and culture at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And welcome to you.
Pleased to be with you.
You've written a very interesting paper discussing how the discovery of new institutions can play an important role in the development of society as new technologies or business practices. And you were specifically speaking, I think, about the forms of corporations and how they develop differently in the West and in the Islamic world.
Yes. Well, the paper that you're referring to examines one of the important causes of the underdevelopment of the Islamic world. Not very long ago, a few centuries ago, the Middle East had a standard of living that was at least as high, if not higher, relative to that of Europe. And commerce played an important role in the successes of the Middle East. However, the Middle Eastern commercial institutions, which are based on Islamic law, did not evolve at a time when European institutions were evolving. Partnerships were giving rise to joint stock companies, to the modern corporation. This dynamic did not occur in the Middle East, which left Middle Eastern traders greatly handicapped by the 19th century.
And why didn't it evolve in the Muslim world?
Well, the reason I think is that the institutions, and in particular a couple of institutions that were highly functional in the Middle Ages, very well adapted to the conditions of the medieval economy, blocked the further development of commercial institutions. And the two institutions that that generated these unintended consequences are the Islamic law of partnerships and the Islamic law of inheritance. The Islamic law of inheritance is critical because it is highly egalitarian and leads to the fragmentation of estates, including commercial enterprises. Mm-hmm. Europe, on the other hand, although it had a very similar partnership, a law of partnerships, the starting point there was the same as in the Middle East. Europe had an inheritance system that was very flexible, and in many places, people were able to, in Europe that is, people were able to prevent the fragmentation of enterprises and assure their continuity and their growth through devices like primogeniture, leaving the entire property, the entire enterprise to the oldest son, for example. So this difference over a long time period proved turned out to be critical. Enterprises in the West grew. As they grew, the growth generated new problems that had to be solved with new institutions. Those institutions that then generated need for further institutions and so on. In the Middle East, however, because every generation enterprises got fragmented, you didn't get this growth, and this dynamic just did not get off the ground. And ultimately, modern institutions, modern economic institutions, commercial institutions, financial institutions had to be imported into the Middle East, into the entire Islamic world from Europe in the 19th century, after it became very, very clear that the Middle Eastern economies, the economies of the Islamic world, just could no longer compete with those of Europe.
And was there a religious reason behind this?
Well, there was some resistance to in the 18th century and early 19th century to bring about reforms, but by then it was quite late. This process had moved on. Europe had very large firms. If there is a deep religious reason, I think this is what you're trying to get at. It has to do with the fact that the inheritance law and the law of partnerships are components of Islamic law.
Okay.
And the inheritance law in particular is anchored in the Quran. This is a very important difference because it means that an important factor because it means that the inheritance law is very difficult to challenge. It's hard to change. In Europe, the inheritance laws were not anchored in the Bible, which meant that they could be changed as could circumstances changed, as new needs arose. Inheritance laws could be changed quite easily without generating religious opposition.
Our next telephone caller is Charlie, who's on the line with us from Walnut Creek, California.
Yes, great subject, Neil. I think the first professor is completely wrong. Religion is a smokescreen for the despotic rulers in the Middle East today. And we know in these areas, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, they have these schools that have trained generations of young people to hate. That's why it's going to take a long time. So they use the religious thing to turn their way as a red herring away so that the young people and the masses won't see the corruption and the despotic governments that are controlling them. So they make the evil the United States. So it's an economic thing, not religion, and this has just been duped on the people. And I think that you should have other scholars on to challenge them instead of being a kind of straight man for your guest, Neil.
Let's give him, Professor Juergensmeyer, a chance to respond.
Well, I think your religion and economics is a seamless part of life. These are various aspects of human existence, and to speak out the use religion as the ideology of rebellion of a situation that involves a sense of economic oppression or loss of opportunity, I think, is not to say that it's one thing or the other. We're talking about two dimensions of the same problem. But perhaps I missed something in the caller's objection.
No, here's the point. The point is these regimes do not want the people to rise up, either Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Iraq. So they say give great money and all the people to these schools to train the people to hate America instead of trying to change their own societies, and they use the religion as a tool, and you fall for it because it's a smokescreen. It's an economic thing. The same thing in Ireland, Northern Ireland. it's battling for economic control, not and they use that as now. Thank God they're starting to see this. But I'm saying in the Middle East, and you fall for it, and let the American people fall for this thing that it's religion. It isn't religion. It's a smokescreen. A red herring is the better metaphor to take the people away from looking at their own regimes.
Well, but an interesting
by the way,
way religion is...
Charlie, let the man respond.
No, let me say one more thing. The Nobel laureate, Vijay, how do you pronounce it?
V.S. Naipaul.
He agrees with me. He said the same thing. I've heard him interviewed on NPR, and he says says the same thing that I'm saying.
Okay.
Well, it's an interesting thing that religion is a part of the ideology of the authorities in the country that you're talking about, like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, but also of rebellion. And when Osama bin Laden came on Al Jazeera television in his tape message right after the American involvement in Afghanistan on October 7th, he made a litany of all of the griefs that Muslims have against America, including Palestine and Iraq and so forth. And then he said, and your own leaders have done nothing about it, thereby accusing all the leadership in the Muslim world of a kind of inability to stand up against the forces of America. And now he's castigating all Arab leaders who support the UN as going against the will of Allah and the Quran. I mean, clearly he's trying to go behind the backs of the Arab leadership and try to appeal directly to the populace to rise up against their own leaders and unite in a kind of pan-Islamic state, perhaps led by Osama bin Laden. So here you have religion both used in the sense to help stabilize the authority of leaders, but also to fuel the voices of dissent.
Our next caller is Tariq, who's on the line with us from Baltimore.
Hi, I just wanted to mention a couple of things, a couple of scholarships that haven't been mentioned. One of them is the work of Dr. Abdelkarim Sarouche and his hermeneutical theory of the expansion and contraction of Sharia. I think a major problem here is
Sharia, the system of Islamic law.
That's exactly right. I really think that a problem here is that Sharia itself has become static. It has become unchanging, and it was never meant to be unchanging. It was supposed to be evolving with the evolving knowledge. I think that really needs to be discussed, especially the work of Dr. Sarouch, and as well as Mohsen Kadiwar. Secondly, I wanted to mention two things on
Before the caller goes on, may I just say a word about Sarouch and the positive role that I think his thinking has had within Iran. And it's an example of the way in which religious involvement in politics can evolve and not necessarily take on a very fundamentalist and narrow position. Sarouch, in some ways, is kind of the Martin Luther of the Islamic world, and sees Islam in a much more varied and interesting way, and its role in public life in a much more open and positive way than a more narrow-minded interpretation might have it.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
I wanted to also mention to you that I think one of the major ideas that's not being discussed is the fact that when we're talking about secularization, I think the big argument within Islam itself is whether we're talking about objective secularization, that's the separation of the church from the state, or are we talking about a subjective secularization, which is to separate from religion or separate religion from culture and from society. I think that's a huge, a tremendous fear, and a major source of consternation, which then shows itself as a division within society against modernity, which I don't believe it is. It is, I believe, against this kind of profanation. I think those issues need to be looked into with more seriousness.
Well, I'd like to give Timur Kuran a chance to respond.
Yes, I think this is an important point has been raised. The
Islam was a very dynamic religion for its first four or five centuries. In fact, many of the institutions, whether we're talking about educational institutions or commercial or financial institutions, did not emerge in the 7th century when Islam arose. They took several centuries to reach their mature form. After that, while certain institutions continued to evolve, while certain understandings continued to be evolved, or certain revisions were made, for example, in the area of taxation, in other areas, the change was quite limited. No fundamental change occurred until the 19th century, and that is what needs to be investigated, and we do need to recognize that there are the same religion that was very dynamic and economically very successful for a few centuries, also carries within it seeds of conservatism and rigidity.
Mm-hmm.
That's something we also need to recognize. Could I make a comment with regard to the previous discussion?
Please.
I think we need to make a distinction when talking about the sources of anger in the Middle East. There are individuals, many individuals, millions of individuals in the Middle East who are simply unable to operate in the economic mainstream, who don't have the resources or the skills to participate in the world economy as equals, and who have no hope of succeeding in the world economy. And such individuals offer fertile terrain for the development of an anti-Western, anti-capitalist, anti-American movement. It's very easy to fill them with envy and hatred. Now, on the other hand, the people who crashed planes into the
World Trade Center, yeah,
in New York were not unemployed people. Some of them were university graduates or were students in universities. They certainly had the skills to make a living. Bin Laden himself is not somebody who needs to go on welfare. So there's clearly something else that is motivating some people. What is motivating these individuals is not material deprivation per se, but an all-consuming ideology. These people are or were not just Muslims, but they're Islamists, or to use another terminology, Islamic fundamentalists, who are pursuing goals they considered higher than life itself.
Timur Karan, thanks very much for joining us today. Very interesting.
You're very welcome.
Timur Karan is a professor of economics and law, as well as a professor of Islamic thought and culture at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. You're listening to part one of a two-day look at Islam. Tomorrow, we'll talk with American Muslim leaders about the role of Islam in American society and the role of American Muslims in the Islamic world. Today, we're talking about the influence of Islam with respect to politics and economics. When we return, Islam and science. You can continue this conversation online. Go to npr.org, click on the discussion section, then scroll down to Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, and you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other National Public Radio stations, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Freedom Forum, creator of The Newseum, the first interactive museum of news, located in Arlington, Virginia, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, saluting America's families this Thanksgiving during National Family Week, on the web at aecf.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The name Arlo Guthrie conjures images of the 1960s. The iconoclastic folk singer and songwriter has been writing and playing music for the past three decades. Now he's embarked on a new project using a full orchestra. I'm Neil Conan. Arlo Guthrie joins us for a live performance and your calls. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, we'll hear from American Muslim leaders about the role of Islam in American society and the role of American Muslims in the Islamic world. That's the second part of our two-day look at Islam. Today, we're talking about how Islamic beliefs have shaped the lives of its adherents. We've discussed politics and economics. We're going to go now into the realm of science, which for centuries found a home in the Islamic world. We'd like you to invite you to join the conversation. Our telephone number, of course, is 800-989-TALK, 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Still with us on the line from Santa Barbara, California, is Professor Mark Juergensmeyer. And joining us now is Jamil Rajep. He's a professor of the history of science at the University of Oklahoma. He is also the coordinator of Middle East Studies there, and he joins us from his office in Norman, Oklahoma. And welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Basically, I would say from the 8th century until the 1400s or so, the Islamic world was the leader in scientific inquiry everywhere in the world. They pioneered much of what we know about mathematics, physics, astronomy, and philosophy. And most of this inquiry came out because of Islam and not despite it. What were the Islamic beliefs at the beginning of the 8th century that caused such a flowering of the sciences?
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind here is that Islam provided a space for science to flourish. It is not so much the beliefs themselves, although one can say that Islam is a religion like other monotheistic religions that seeks to glorify God by understanding his creation. But by creating a space where different civilizations that had existed previously and peoples of those civilizations could come together, we had a very important event in world history, namely a multicultural flourishing that, in a sense, Islam, by allowing Jews, Christians, and others to interact and bring their ideas together, allowed for science to flourish during those early centuries.
And a lot of Greek and Roman ideas as well.
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. What later caused the eventual stagnation of science in the Islamic world?
This is the $64 question, I guess.
Might want to add a few zeros there.
Right, exactly.
That was another Islamic invention, too.
Right.
The zero.
Well, actually, it's the decimal fraction. The zeros were there, but they added the decimal and the fraction.
Okay.
But the other side of it, which one can date variously from 1500 even on to, you know, even later, in some ways, it's not so much that it disappeared, but that Europe overtook Islam and developed its science in new and interesting ways that led to our modern scientific traditions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even into the 18th, 19th century, science in the older, you know, let's say Ptolemaic astronomy and other traditions were still being taught in madrasas, in schools. In fact, when I was in Iran recently, I met a very old gentleman, I think he's deceased since then, who had actually studied in a madrasa the ancient scientific traditions of Ptolemy.
Mm-hmm. Are there some who believe that everything that is needed to be known is in the Quran and therefore all the science you need to know is there?
Yes, but in a way this is a fairly modern belief. It's interesting that in the Middle Ages, if you went to an Islamic school, a madrasa, more likely than not, you would study, in terms of cosmology and other things, of Ptolemaic astronomy or Ptolemaic cosmology. In other words, the mm-hmm. cosmology of the Greeks or the physics of the Greeks.
Where the universe revolves around the Earth.
Right. But this was, in other words, but this was coming from a non-Quranic, non-Islamic source. So, you know, we have literally thousands of manuscripts of, Greek astronomy that probably were suffered through by generations of students in these schools.
Mm-hmm.
But it does show that, you know, during the time, it was not necessarily the case that people thought that
all knowledge about the natural world came from the Quran. But interestingly enough, that in recent years, that belief has spread.
I can almost hear Mark Juergensmeyer saying that there's creationism in the Christian world as well.
That's right. I think that's an excellent point, and one can see what we might call the rise of Islamic science, just as we've seen in the West the rise of Christian science.
And yet there's also a sense, though, within the Islamic world that it's not just a matter of modernity that is in conflict with every religion, but also that in some ways the greatness of Islamic civilization has been eclipsed. Very interesting, in Osama bin Laden's recent talks on Al Jazeera television, he said, talking about the oppression of the West, and he cited a figure. He said, for 80 years now, you know, Islam has been under oppression. Now, that's an interesting date, because if you go back 80 years, what happened 80 years ago? Well, I think he's talking about the fall of the caliphate and the end of the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
That historical sense that there was once a grandeur, a great empire, a great civilization of science and technology that's now eclipsed by the West, that someone like Osama bin Laden is very mindful of in his own kind of megalomania, thinking he can restore Islam to its rightful place in history.
Let's go back to the phones. Our caller is Charlie, who's on the line with us from San Jose, California.
Hi, I wanted to address that $64 question.
I see you're not a believer in inflation.
No, sure, $64,000. But in the medieval period, you had three civilizations: the Latin Western Church, the Eastern Church, and Islam. And something happened in the Western Church where Thomas Aquinas and his school of thought triumphed, and that led to science, the embrace of science, and eventually to the Enlightenment and the Protestant Reformation, I believe. People like Thomas Aquinas in Islam and in the Eastern Church, like Paul of Damascus, were defeated on theological grounds, that the way you should go within those religions was not towards scholasticism and rational learning, but towards revelation and mysticism. And because of that, Islam fell behind and is now dragging along, because they never adopted capitalism or science really the way the West did. They're now sort of doomed to follow along behind the Protestant West, who is the leader in science and technology. The English language is now dominant. And until there is an Islamic Reformation similar to the Protestant Reformation, I don't think things are going to change. And I wonder why there has not been a reformation in Islam similar to the Protestant Reformation.
Well, while hastening to point out that Thomas Aquinas was not a Protestant, I understand. Let's let Jamil Rajib answer this.
Well, in interesting ways, I think Islam was evolving, and there is a sense that one gets in the centuries, let's say, from the 12th through the 15th, 16th centuries, which are the crucial centuries in which Europe developed. One gets the sense in Islam as well that there is an attempt to separate scientific work, let's say, from both religious doctrine, but also, interestingly, from philosophy. And here one can make the analogy with someone like Galileo, who was doing something along the same lines.
And who did have his problems with the Catholic Church.
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But one has to keep in mind that during the period of the gentleman is speaking about, from Aquinas on, and I should say that Aquinas is very heavily indebted to Islamic philosophy and theology as well. During that period of time, science did not suddenly blossom. It took quite a long period of time. And in Islam, during those centuries, one could say that from the 13th to the 15th century is, in fact, the real golden age of Islamic science, when one sees the building of the great observatories in Marah and Samarkand, and other remarkable events, the discovery of circulation of blood between the heart and lungs, and, one could go on.
We could go on.
Right. But
something happened then that, I mean, Thomas Aquinas was opposed within the church, and my understanding is that the forces in Islam that became stronger, that were opposed to this line of development, and things sort of just stalled in Islam. So instead of developing a freedom of conscience separate from the dictates of the priests, you society was still controlled by the priests. The interpretation of the Quran was not, you know, whereas in Protestant, after the Protestant Reformation, you had individuals developing freedom of conscience to interpret scripture in their own individual ways. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to have developed in Islam.
Well, actually,
Charlie, I'm going to let...
There's a view of the history of Islam. I mean, there are great movements of toleration of the Islamic rule in India under Akbar, or in Spain, and the Moors were more tolerant than other forms of rule.
Let me just excuse me, Professor. I just need to break in to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Please go ahead. I'm sorry I had to interrupt there.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
No, my point is that this, the kind of stridency that we're seeing, is a relatively new phenomenon, and even within Islamic militancy, the so-called fundamentalists, there is still an appreciation of science, of technology. The kind of people who were involved in the attack on the World Trade Center were, as a previous caller pointed out, in every way very modern professional people. So it's not modernity as such. It's modernism, that is, the sense that the secular ideology of the West and all of the implications for power and economic and political and military control that are implied in that is dominating the Arab world. That's what's being resisted. So it really is a resistance on the basis of power and authority and control, and not a rejection of science and technology and the other elements of modernity.
Professor Rajep?
I would certainly agree with that. And I think one of the points that needs to be made and reiterate, and I think all three of us are saying this to various degrees, that there's nothing inherent in Islam that one can say is against science, against commerce, against whatever. And Islam developed all kinds of strategies, abilities, historically, to deal with a variety of things. And if one thinks about it, one of the most remarkable things that ever happened in world history was that this society that was set up by people coming out of the desert, very unsophisticated, could adapt in such a way to bring into itself the greatest ideas of the ancient world.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. Obviously, we could go on, and probably we will at a different time. But thanks to you all. And Charlie, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks to Jamil Rajep, professor of history of science at the University of Oklahoma, also the coordinator of Middle East Studies there. He joined us from his office in Norman, Oklahoma. Good to talk to you, sir.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
And thanks to Mark Juergensmeyer, professor of sociology and director of global and international studies at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Also the author of Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence. He joined us from his home in Santa Barbara. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
We want to hear from you for our Thursday letters and follow-up segment. If that great question comes to mind after we go off the air, don't worry. Send us an email with your question. Please type follow-up in the subject line, and we'll give you a chance to ask your question to one of our guests. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Don't forget to include a daytime phone number so we can reach you. If you have a critique or a comment on something you heard on Talk of the Nation, we'd like to hear from you as well. The best way to reach us is, again, by email, the same address, totn@npr.org. Please type letters in the subject line. For letter writers, our address is National Public Radio, Talk of the Nation, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. Please don't forget to include a tip on how to pronounce your name. Well, my name is Neil Conan. I'm in Washington, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This program is a production of National Public Radio. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. NPR is solely responsible for this program. Tapes and transcripts of this program are available. Call anytime, toll-free, 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-TEXT. NPR TEXT.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org, the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation for reporting on biological resource issues, and Raymond James, listening to investors since 1962, independent advice and financial planning through over 2,000 offices coast to coast. Information at RaymondJames.com. This is NPR National Public Radio.
President Bush and other coalition leaders take pains to portray this war as a fight against terrorism, not Islam. Many American Muslims say the same thing. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for part two of our discussion of Islam. We'll speak with American Muslim leaders about the role of Islam in America and the role of American Muslims in the Islamic world. That's the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.